You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Every week, we recite or sing a prayer we call the Lord's Prayer. But it really might be better if we called it the Disciples' Prayer. After all, they're the words Rabbi Yeshua gave his followers when they asked for a prayer of their own. Plus, there's probably a better candidate for the title, the Lord's Prayer, and it's our passage today. John has Jesus fervently praying on the eve of his betrayal and death, but something's not quite right. There's something odd about this prayer. In the other Gospels, we're used to Jesus laying out short, pithy, straightforward sayings, but if you think our passage today sounds pretty esoteric, you'd be right. Throughout John's Gospel, it's clear that the author was influenced by the Greek philosophy of Plato. You might remember that Plato constructed the world in two distinct planes. The higher plane is ideas, forms, and other abstractions. But the only way anyone can experience those ideas, forms, and abstractions is in their concrete forms here in the real world. So for the author of John, Jesus served to bridge these two planes, bringing with him elements of both. So here we have the author of John portraying Jesus praying with all the hope and love and intensity and anguish that he can muster, while at the same time expressing a kind of cross between Platonic philosophy and Lennon and McCartney lyrics. I am you, and you are he, as you are me, and we are all together.
Our words of wisdom are from John chapter 17, verses 22 and 23.
Jesus prayed, "The glory that you have given me, I have given them, so they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may become completely one, so that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
When I read Jesus saying, "As you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you've sent me," I can't help but have a flashback to that singular moment of crisis in my life, that moment where countless millions of my generation came face to face with the thought that everything that we'd thought we knew up to that point was false, and we could no longer trust our assumptions about good and evil.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No, I am your father.
No. No. It's not true. That's impossible!
Search your feelings. You know it to be true.
No! No!
No! Tell me it's not true! I don't know if you remember, but for people of a certain age, this was a defining moment, an iconic moment that took Star Wars from Saturday morning serial to Greek tragedy, embodying Joseph Campbell's teachings on the power of myth. I'm kind of bummed that my kids will never have that experience. They've grown up always knowing that Darth Vader is Luke's father and the whole backstory. They will forever be denied that crisis moment where the whole theater gasped together, along with Luke, and tried to deny what we'd just heard. But what George Lucas did was use the power of story to make a point that needs to be made over and over again. Just when you think you've got evil or the other, them, all figured out, there's something more that you didn't know. And it may force you to reevaluate everything you thought you knew up to that point. Here's the problem we're all wrestling with. Dualistic, all or nothing, us versus them thinking. It's rampant in our culture today. It's obvious in our politics, in our religions, and in our relationships, even in our advertising. Evidently, the only two options are use our toothpaste or die. This false dilemma reduces almost every situation to just two choices, where everything other than these two extreme options are omitted. But most of the time, those two options are not the only choices available. And as Luke Skywalker found out, there are always things about the other that you didn't know. But we are conditioned to reduce everything to simple black and white thinking. Us versus them. We are good. They are evil. There's no nuance. It's always a clear right and wrong. But last week, we started to learn about this African concept called Ubuntu. We learned that Ubuntu expresses a complex idea that is uncomfortable for many people. In one word, it expresses the idea that every person depends on other persons in order to be a whole person. In other words, I am because we are. Ubuntu emphasizes a communal and spiritual dimension of human identity that challenges the mindset of thinking of oneself only as an individual. It's humanity's old nemesis again, dualism, where we try to bifurcate our whole world into us versus them. Me good, you bad, especially if you're different from me somehow. Ubuntu is a corrective for us in the West who stress individualism to the exclusion of community, all but canceling out concern for the other. But that's not what's portrayed in today's John passage. It's more about the divine spark being realized best in a relationship. I pray that they may all be one, as you, Abba, are in me, and I am in you, may they also be in us. This Plato-infused Jesus prayer sounds an awful lot like Ubuntu. Plus, rewind from John's Greek Jesus to Jewish Jesus, and you'll find it at the heart of the Jewish tradition. I've shared with you before how one of my mentors, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, laments how so many people get Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself, wrong. They quote it as, love your neighbor as you love yourself. No! People say, well, I have to work on loving myself before I can love my neighbor. Nope, that's not what the text says. It says, love your neighbor as yourself. Not as you love yourself, as though they are a part of you, integrated, connected, and one with one another. Ubuntu! I am because we are. Be it different nationalities, races, colors, religions, sexual orientations, gender identities, beliefs, or worldviews, everyone is an extension of you. Remember back to our Julian series and what Julian wrote about being one with one another? The love of God creates in us such a oneing that when it is truly seen, no person can separate themselves from another person. And in the sight of God, All humans are one, and one person is all people, and all people are in one person. Even God's favorite band, U2, has a song about it. One love, one blood, one life. You got to do what you should. One life with each other, sisters, brothers. One life, but we're not the same. We get to carry each other, one. Woohoo! So, you know what you get when you put Leviticus, Jesus, Julian of Norwich, U2, and Ubuntu all together? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Pie in the sky, claptrap. That's what you get. Most people just don't get it. We can join hands and sing about oneness and love and peace on earth, and guess what? It doesn't happen. If you haven't noticed by now, it doesn't matter how hard you believe in the magical interventionist God of your youth. This God is simply unwilling or unable to unilaterally make all these unicorn and rainbow wishes come true. Some things we just have to do ourselves. And it takes effort to work against the primal forces of our reptilian brains and tens of thousands of generations of tribal conditioning to be suspicious of the other. Add to that the objective reality that all values simply are not equal. Whatever I preach, however long I preach, I haven't been able to figure out how to begin to approach being one with white supremacists or fundamentalists of any religion, especially Christianity. Or take, for instance, the woman who accidentally showed up at the 1 in 10 meeting for LGBTQ youth this week at the Fountains. She'd inadvertently come to the wrong church. When she was told what the meeting she had crashed was, she was incensed that such a group even existed and vowed to return, supposedly to protest. It's hard to tell. I am not one with these people. They are the them of the us versus them attitude I'm supposedly telling you how to overcome in this sermon. Then there are those who mock United Methodists for being intolerant. Well, you say you're tolerant, but you don't accept those who have different opinions. That's right. We tolerate just about anything but intolerance. So yeah, I guess that makes us intolerant. So where does that leave us? I'll tell you where it leaves me. Grateful. Grateful that there's a place like the Fountains that can serve as a beacon for a way of looking at the world that often takes a beating out there in practice. You may not hear it as often as I do, but as an example, when we were hosting the Buddhist meditation class, I had several non-Fountains attendees come up to me and say, "Pastor, we don't belong to this church, but we wanted you to know how grateful we are for what this church does and what it stands for." Right? These are people that are never going to be members or attend services. But by doing what we're doing, being who we are, putting love first, we are offering people who would otherwise feel alone a sense of solidarity and hope. So say what you will. It's unrealistic. It's just a waste of time talking about all that pie-in-the-sky nonsense. But I will argue that doggedly and persistently holding up a core value like Ubuntu is a vital spiritual practice for us and a practical civic responsibility for the community. In his book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, eminently practical business guru Stephen Covey says The second habit is to begin with the end in mind. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're envisioning the outcome we want. Oneness. Everywhere you turn, the vision of those trying to drag the human race to the next level of consciousness is the same. It's set forth by Leviticus, Jesus, Rumi, Julian, Dr. Seuss, and countless other mystics and visionaries who have gone before us. A world that embodies Ubuntu, to know that we are one. Now, I get it. It seems that the days are gone where people of different views are even able to sit down and just have a civil conversation. Social media, fundamentalist thinking, and politicians have poisoned our society with a steady drumbeat of us versus them, confirmation bias, salacious sound bites, and the demonization of anyone who doesn't look, talk, sound, believe, or act just like us. So we hunker down and isolate ourselves, virtually guaranteeing the continued entropy of potential oneness. The solution? Don't give up. Keep looking for those connections. Keep supporting one another in the effort. Keep finding creative ways to bridge the gaps between yourself and those with whom you disagree. Look, we are not going to overcome the us versus them mindset anytime soon. But if we can keep the end in mind, if we can keep our sights set on what an evolving human race needs to aim for in order to survive, we're doing what we've been called to do. Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh has written, "I support you. You support me. I am in this world to offer you peace. You are in this world to bring me joy." We may not be able to overcome us versus them thinking, but together we can show the world a path to peace, a formula for joy, and an alternative way of living they didn't even know they needed. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.